This is Mike Boileau of Lexicon Valley.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Are you one of those people who sometimes uses words?
Do you communicate or acquire information with, you know, language?
Hey, us too. So join us on Lexicon Valley to chew over the history, culture, and many mysteries of English, plus some wisecracks.
Find us on one of those apps where people listen to podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to episode 239 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics in modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
A new Pew Research Center survey of 25 countries found something striking. The United States is the only country where more people say their fellow citizens are morally bad than morally good. Americans are not uniquely strict about behavior such as divorce, gambling, or marijuana use, and on most individual moral questions, we fall somewhere in the middle globally. Yet, when asked to judge each other, we stand alone in our negativity. Rick, today I'm hoping we can talk about moral pessimism, isolation, and whether we have become too quick to see our fellow citizens as ethically broken. But do you think when a majority of people believe their countrymen lack morals, that can hurt our democracy?
Well, absolutely, because it's an indication that social trust has broken down. We tend not to trust people that we think of as bad. And so if we think a majority of other Americans are morally bad, we're probably not going to trust them. And then it's very hard for us to try to act in good faith, to be committed to persuasion as the mode of governing. And we're kind of seeing that, like we're seeing a lot of political fighting right now that is ultimately detrimental to the entire country.
And as I was seeing this survey, I was trying to figure out and go through like a list of things in my mind as to why our country is like especially bad at this. And, you know, you could quickly rule out things like social media, because we talk about and have talked about many times on this show about like all the ills of social media, but Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, I mean, all these things exist in almost every country in the world. So I don't think, I mean, we all may use it slightly differently, but I don't think that's, I could not point my finger at that.
Well, and just like 92% of Canadians think that most other Canadians are morally good.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and 85% of Australians, right?
Yeah, and like they're on Facebook too.
Yeah, they use social, maybe not quite as much, but just about it. So that's
So I was just trying to think of all the other reasons why that might be. And I also think that we've like gotten, it's not like we have a long history of this as a country. I think we've gotten worse at this as a country. And so I just couldn't help but think it, and because maybe we are worse at this than other countries, is that we have just had a great diminishment of how we look at our civic responsibilities, how we view our institutions. But and again, some of that's happening elsewhere, and what I hope isn't happening is that many trends start in America and sort of get disseminated across the world. I hope this is not one of them. But as we see people in our country being so much more disinvolved in their local governments, polarized about some of what's going on nationally, and sort of othering the people who they disagree with, I don't think all of those are especially traits that we own here in our country, but it seems like we're probably worse at that than other places.
So the first question you have to ask is, are Americans right?
Well,
are Americans actually bad, morally bad than citizens of other countries? That's probably not what's going on. I mean, the survey doesn't even explore that option.
True.
That's the first possibility. And is it self-fulfilling? If we regard other Americans as morally bad, do we start treating one another worse? And I think there is something to that. And a couple summers ago, my wife and I took a road trip around Lake Superior. Basically, half of it is in Canada and half of it's in the United States. And we started out northern Minnesota along the north shore of Lake Superior, and then we entered into like Thunder Bay, that area. And then we camped at a number of campgrounds along that northern coast of Lake Superior in Canadian provincial parks. And then we came back down to Sault Ste. Marie into Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and then along that southern coast of, and camped in some Michigan state parks along there. There was a noticeable difference in attitude among the other campers when we went from Canada into Michigan and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it was so striking because when we were in the Canadian parks, people would walk by, we'd be setting up our campground. People would be walking by and saying hi. Sometimes they'd stop and talk. They would invite us to come over to their campground later and join us by their campfire. Like, this happened routinely at the Canadian sites. We get to America, and we had, after just a week of this, we'd started gotten accustomed to that. And we noticed there was a kind of defensiveness. Like, we noticed the Americans would come into their campsite and start putting out all these possessions. There was a lot more stuff, for example. Started pulling stuff out of the trucks and kind of setting up a perimeter of their campground. It's like they're putting up their boundary markers. This is our space and stay out of it. It was not spoken in that way, but it was kind of the sense that you got. And it was the first time that I'd seen, just overnight, from one day to the next, in a very short geographical difference, like this difference of attitude among people towards one another. And I think there is something kind of deep in this survey that it's not just that we have this false perception of one another. We have somehow corrupted our relationships with one another by this perception that others are going to take something. They're other people are a threat to us.
And here's one theory, and that I think may possibly explain what you saw. And this is maybe another one of those, why is the U.S. worse at this than everywhere else? And I wish I could give credit to this person, but I don't remember who I heard say it. But I'm sure it's been said by others. Is the United States, like, as a landmass, too big? And what do I mean by that? So obviously Canada is probably, I think, bigger, but like Canada, the people, like, I'm making this up, but like 3/4 of the population of Canada lives like in one little corner of the country. I mean, it's a big country, but people are not spread out across it widely. So I think that's a little different. But like the United States is a big country, but we have, and we certainly have parts of the middle of our country that are not very densely populated, but we also are a country where the people who are extremely left-leaning, who may live in one part of our nation and believe one whole set of things, and if those are people who are far on the left, they might look at the people who live in, we'll say, the Deep South, which is a much redder part of our country, and have a whole different set of beliefs, and look down upon them for what they believe. And I'm sure in some ways that's reciprocal. The people in the South believe what they believe and think the people who are in those lefty coastal cities just don't understand what being an American is all about. And because we have, you know, what are we at, 330 million citizens or some huge number like that? Is it just that we're too big in so many ways to have this sort of cohesive society that, like, is much easier to have if you live in Denmark or Finland or these much more compact countries that don't have as wide of types of people? There's also, I'll point out, the immigration and makeup of those societies is more narrow than what we have in the U.S. And are we just so big that we naturally have so many people who think differently than us is that that leads to mistrust.
I don't think that's it.
Okay.
I mean, because, you know, Canada and Australia, relative to their population, are even bigger geographically, right?
Yeah, and but like in Australia, more. Everybody lives like on the outer ring, like 17 people live in the center, and I've not been to Australia, but they, yeah. I don't think they play a big role in that country's culture.
But we, like, we have this urban-rural divide.
Sure.
Right? And it's a left-right divide, rural and
typically.
Urban. Typically. And those divides happen even within states.
Yes.
Right? But you get the same kind of rural-urban divide, for example, in the UK. And yet, you have really high levels of confidence in the moral goodness of fellow citizens in the UK relative to the US. So there could be something to that. I think it's more tied to the growing economic disparity.
And, which is certainly an American, we are quite good at that.
Well, and if you look at the Gini Index, which is the shows us what is the disparity between wealth and poverty, like the economic divide between the rich and the poor in a nation. Like in the 1950s and 60s, we were about the same as that in that disparity as countries like Sweden, UK, Canada, Australia, United States. We're all about the same, all these Western democracies. And we had really robust, what we call middle America,
yeah.
The middle class was really robust. Those countries like Canada, for example, still has a fairly robust middle class. We do not. And so we've seen a real divergence where we've seen a growing divide between wealth and poverty, and these other nations haven't. And I think this experience of the growing divide has made us less trustful and more suspicious of one another.
Meaning that people with less means may demonize those with more money and how they spend it, and people with who have that money look down on the people who don't as being lazy or unambitious. Is that sort of like oversimplifying?
Yeah, that's oversimplifying, but it's like that.
Yeah.
It's a misperception and caricatures, but we're increasingly being. It's not just that there's an economic divide. We're separating socially along those economic divides.
Oh,
also, we
absolutely.
Don't know as many people. Right, we're not as connected socially to the people at different levels, and we even see that in the public places where we go. Like it used to be, like you're a big fan of baseball.
Yep.
You used to go to a ballpark, say in the 1970s, and everybody kind of sat in the same areas. I mean, you could find yourself, you know, just barely affording to buy a ticket, but you might not be sitting in the same row as a millionaire, but you're going and you're getting beer or hot dogs at during the inning break to the same stand.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're not. Now
The
luxury boxes and there's all these tiers and everything, and you park in different areas. You
different entrances.
We're completely segregated economically, and this creates more misunderstanding, more distrust, and a lack of appreciation for how other people are responding to different kinds of social events in the world.
And if that's true, which probably is, but like the question I started off with was saying, how is this bad for democracy? Maybe you can explain better than me what these attitudes, not only, you know, it's bad that we don't trust our neighbors, but how can this spill into a negative outlook for how we govern our citizens?
Well, if we are becoming both socially and economically more segregated, it's much harder for us to deliberate on a common good because we don't have the direct experience of what the good is for all of us. What we see is more and more we see what is good for our own people based on my own experience of as I live life. I really saw this when I lived in Memphis for a few years, and we would, my wife and I just arrived there, and when we'd be invited, say, to come to a colleague's house, you know, for dinner or something on a weekend, and we'd get out a map when we'd look at, like, how do we get there? And we'd drive these city streets, and a question we often got that kind of perplexed us is, well, how did you get here? What streets did you take? And we'd tell them, and they say, oh, you didn't travel down that street, did you? Hmm. Like they were well-known, what were perceived as both impoverished neighborhoods and the dangerous streets that you don't ever go on. And we quickly realized that people who lived there for a long time would always drive on the same streets, but then they would have a very different perception of what their city was like. So when you talk to them like what's it like to live in Memphis, their response is from what they experience, but they aren't experiencing huge sections of it because they're not even driving through it.
But are you saying that their perception is wrong because they only see the nice, shiny parts of the city with all the people who look like them and maybe sit in the same economic stratification as them? Or do you think that these people have an incorrect, oftentimes, picture in their minds of what the people in, quote, the bad parts of town look like and how they behave and what they do? Or is it, it's probably both of those things, right, that lead to that improper perception?
Both of those. So they thought, like, some of the worst conditions about the city were things they didn't have direct experience of, and so they underestimated the extent of problems with the, like, with the basic infrastructure and housing and different things in their own city. But they also had, because their understanding of people who lived in those areas was largely imaginary without direct experience, they didn't have an accurate picture. And so it's both of those things.
And when they were, if they would have been asked, do you trust the people that live on those mysterious and dangerous streets that you never visit, their answer is probably no.
Well, in fact, it's no. And I had a friend I was talking to about that who was a member of a biking group, and they would take bike rides every weekend. And so members of the group would take turns organizing the route, preparing the route. So he prepares a route that's taking this group through some of the most impoverished areas in Memphis. And when other members of the group saw that, we can't drive down, that's really dangerous. And he said,
and of course,
no,
daytime and stuff.
Daytime, yeah. He said, no, it'll be fine. Like, and they go down, they had all these people sitting on their porches waving to them and stuff. And like most of the members of the group were really surprised. Like, they weren't threatened by the people who lived there. They were welcomed. Like, thank you for, like, even coming through our neighborhood. Nobody comes here. Like, nobody comes down the street. Thank you for, like, it was that kind of response which completely surprised them. And so when we don't have direct experience of our fellow citizens, we labor under these misunderstandings, and I think we get it wrong. And I think a lot of these survey results are a result of us not having direct experience of our neighbors.
But I think that's true. But also, I think if I were to say to people that, yeah, it's easy to have this characterization of these people in a neighborhood you never meet and you never go to and you really don't know much about. But like, if you happen to find yourself sitting next to that person in whatever scenario that is, I mean, they're probably going to be an okay person. And like, most people kind of instinctively, like, yeah, you know, I think most people kind of instinctively know that, because it's dangerous to paint a group of people you don't know in such a terrible negative way. But when you meet one of them, it's usually a pretty good experience. But it seems like maybe the problem is we don't have those experiences enough anymore, because we've sorted ourselves into these geographic regions, sometimes in our cities or sometimes across our country, that we just don't have the, it takes a lot of repetition to realize that if this happens once, it's just sort of an anomaly. But if you continue to meet people who you think are going to be bad and they're like not, that after a while, you start to learn that lesson.
Yeah. And we've been increasingly building our cities in such a way to make it harder to interact with people of different economic levels in our society. And that's a bad thing for democracy. I mean, if we really care for the future of our democracy, we have to start building differently. Like, that's part of the answer. The other thing is, like, we can also choose to act differently. Like, just because I don't have to go to certain areas of my city or to visit certain parts of my country doesn't mean I shouldn't or I can't. This is very important. Where do you choose to take vacation? Like, for example, where do you choose to do your business and your shopping? Like, if we really care about the future of our country, we have to look at more what sociologists term economic connectedness.
But the tricky part is that I think everything you say is true, and people can listen to folks like you talk about it and say why it's important and maybe start to believe it and maybe start to even do it. But, like, even if you have the most well-intentioned government out there, it's almost, I can't think of any policies you can put in place to, like, incentivize this behavior. I suppose that's, as I say that, I think there are some things around zoning rules that cities can do. But, like, the by definition, we live in a country that says you can, like, live wherever you want to live and you can go wherever you want to go. And I don't think we ever want to, like, not have that be the case. So it is hard to have the government play a role in this. I guess it just falls on us.
Yeah, it mostly falls on us. And even if it's a government role, because we're in a democracy, that still falls on us, like what we want our government to do. But, for example, when we're being asked as taxpayers to fund a new stadium, right?
Professional sports stadium specifically.
Yes. Like, how is that stadium designed? And is it designed to integrate us or is it designed to separate us? And, like, that's a very basic question we should be asking. And we should be saying, if we're being asked to help fund something that separates us socially and economically and contributes to this misunderstanding, we should not do that because we're being asked to fund something that's essentially anti-democratic.
The other thing, and I know people like this, and my assumption is you may know people like this too, who just believe that this particular moment of time in our country is awful and we're polarized. And I know I was talking to a friend the other day who, like, legitimately thinks that we are on the precipice of a national civil war. I don't personally buy that premise. I think we're divided. I think in some ways we're too lazy to go to war. I mean, that sounds bad. But I also think, though, that our politicians, we just got done saying there's not a lot of public prescriptions and policy to address some of this. I think sometimes the opposite is true, is that I think some politicians look at the chaos or the misunderstandings and do try to weaponize that a little bit. And I think that is sort of the worst of all outcomes, is saying, look at all these dangerous inner cities, which is sort of a coded term in ways, and we need to be tough on crime and root out all these terrible people. And I think that what happens so often, especially more recently in our country's history, is that, like, things are probably fine, and then the government gets involved and creates a chaotic mess, and then the government comes in and says, well, there's a chaotic mess, and we better fix this. And that's just not good.
That is not good. I don't know what the solution is, but I think overall we can look at group behavior and say that whenever you have a group where there's no appreciable external threat, and we haven't had a real appreciable external threat, I don't think, since World War II. I mean, at that time, I think we came really close to being conquered by Japan, for example.
And that would have changed things.
Absolutely. And whether we actually came that close or not, the fact is Americans believed it
and acted
on it and came together. And a lot of the extreme political differences, like the political infighting, was very great prior to World War II. And then we saw a cessation of that and more focus on working together. We had everything kind of blow up internally during the 1960s. And we talked in the last episode a little bit about what happened. I mean, the amount of division and the amount of rancor, I mean, among citizens for one another during the 60s was really great. I mean, we had all kinds of riots in the cities.
And also, it was not too far from the beginning of TVs in everyone's home, so everybody could see this, like, on the evening news.
Yeah, see it happening. And then we have a pretty significant depression, a recession, but like interest rates for a while were over 20%, and gas prices were high, and there was long gas lines. And these are things that most people right now don't remember at all, or were born after it happened. But that kind of brings Americans together again. And so the answer to our problems is probably some really significant external threat. And so we'll see what happens with our current conflict with Iran. But it is possible that this becomes a significant threat, both economically and militarily. And it is the sort of thing that typically brings groups out of their infighting and towards a kind of unity. And what happens when there's that kind of unity, we stop seeing each other as morally bad. What I'm saying here is one of the reasons we might, like, America might be much worse than other countries at our views of fellow Americans is simply because we're so successful, we've been so dominant economically and militarily that we've had no enemies. And when you have no enemies, you divide into groups and you fight one another.
Where I want to end our conversation is a term I think you mentioned earlier in the show. But I think one of the also contributing causes to this is that we don't think that our fellow citizens, or oftentimes even our local and national leaders, are acting in good faith. That we think that they're, and well, sometimes it's true, but are acting in putting their own interests ahead of those of the people who elected them and the people who they serve. And I think what can also happen is if you believe a leader is acting in bad faith and is not putting his or her constituents first, I think the natural reaction to that is that I don't like that leader. And also, I don't like each and every person who voted that leader into office. That is how a democracy works, though. I mean, we elect people. They do things that we like, and sometimes they do things that we don't like, and we can then, if they run for re-election, decide if we want to elect them again, and that all is like how things work. But is it also how things work that we should be blaming those who elected someone who puts the country or their communities in a worse direction? And I think that happens a lot, right? If you think our war in Iran right now is bad, and that it's going to be a cost that is we're going to be paying for many years to come, and Donald Trump made that choice, and oh, by the way, you voted for Donald Trump. Well, I hate Donald Trump's action in Iran, so I therefore hate you. I think that happens a lot. Is that the correct reaction to when politicians that we elect do things we don't like?
It seems inevitable, and yet it's not a correct response. And one of the reasons is that we're in a really strange situation politically right now, or with political perception, in that the partisan divide has never been greater. So those who identify as Democratic and those who identify Republican tend to take very strong and extreme positions on a whole variety of issues and have almost nothing in common. And yet, at the same time, there's this hyper-partisanship. At the same time, more Americans identify as independent politically than as either strongly Republican or strongly Democratic. And so, like, the people who are largely electing different administrations, the past couple of administrations, the Biden administration or the Trump administration in office, the people who are making the difference aren't the extreme partisans. They are people who consider themselves largely independent and swing one way or the other. And so this perception that like there's a whole group of people that are to blame, say 51% of the American people are to blame for putting that person into office, it's just wrong, because they are not the hyper partisans, and they're not the people that are leading the charge, say on social media or elsewhere, with the very extreme views.
And also, I think we've talked about this before, but I think we greatly, greatly underestimate the number of people who are persuadable about issues that are important to our country and candidates to whom we elect to those positions. Yeah, we hear so much from the people on the far edges of our political discourse, but there are so many people in the middle who, A, don't follow politics very closely at all, and B, when they do, sort of like take a look around and see how their life's going, see how their family's doing, and if they're happy, maybe stay the course, and if they're unhappy, look for who's talking about change the most. And it doesn't go a lot deeper than that sometimes.
So you're saying they're persuadable, and I think you're right. Like, there's people that are existing kind of in the middle, but they're also opting out of political discussions. And there's more and more people that aren't really following the news very much, not following politics, and really dislike talking about political topics.
Well,
and
especially when they see people just yelling about such things.
Well, that's it. We are, as a society, we're losing the art of persuasion. So we're losing the ability to talk to one another about what's good for us as a country. And that's really essential. That's the most important thing about a democracy. We start out talking about, is this a good or a bad thing that we think of most other Americans as morally bad? That's a bad thing. But the worst thing is if we give up on talking to one another constructively and persuasively and thinking that it makes a difference when we do that, right? We should be more engaged, but engage in a commitment to persuasive dialogue.
And, Rick, this year of 2026 is the 250th anniversary of our country.
The sesquicentennial.
Is that called? I have to look it up.
Is it harder to pronounce?
It's harder to pronounce than that. And I think by the midsummer, we may all know how to pronounce the word.
Really hard to pronounce.
I'll look it up here as we talk. But it does seem to me like if there ever were a time to sort of embrace these values, now would be the moment, right?
Yeah, now would be the moment. But it's like, I think now is the moment to be able to pronounce the word.
Well, the word is semi-quincentennial.
Oh, that's right. Not the sesquicentennial.
Yeah, semi-quincentennial.
Semi-quincentennial.
The 250th anniversary. So when you and Mrs. Kite mark your 250th year together, that's a word you'll have to know.
Oh, semi-quin. I have to remember semi-quin. Semi-quin centennial. Okay, there we go.
And that's a word as July 4th approaches this year. And who knows, maybe we'll even put that on our calendars as the summer months get here.
Are you going to invest in a new flag?
A
new flag for your porch?
Oh, I don't have a flag on my porch. Do you?
No, I'm getting one though.
Because of?
Of the semi-quintennial.
Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Thank you for asking, Scott. Let's say you're traveling through a town where an old friend lives, and you haven't seen this person for a long time. So you call him up and ask if he'd like to get together for lunch the next day. He says yes, but then you hear him coughing over the phone, and you ask, you say, are you feeling okay? And he says, well, I'm home from work because I've got a bad cold, but I'm pretty sure I'll feel well enough tomorrow to go to lunch. Do you just say okay and go to lunch, or do you back out of that invitation?
I think especially because you framed this up as I'm traveling through a town, and I'm assuming I'm not 20 minutes outside of where I live, that I'm on some sort of longer vacation.
Yep.
And I think I would use that as a pretty realistic excuse to say, hey, we're in the middle of a vacation, and the last thing I or the people I'm traveling with want is to come down with something, even though it's probably not super serious like a cold. But instead of just saying no, and I guess a little depends on the time of the year and when you're traveling, but I think one thing we did not take nearly enough advantage of during COVID was spending time outside.
Right.
And like I remember, and it was actually in a little bit of a transition season. It was not a sunny 70 degree day. I think if my memory serves, it was like a cloudy 50 degree day. But I was, and this was during like the bad months of COVID, is that a friend and I were going to get together, and he contacted me a day or so before and said, hey, you know, I don't know quite what this is. I'm not feeling 100%, but I'm not feeling bad. Like, what would you say if we just got together and went on a walk? And, you know, that's not like risk-free, sure, but like few things in life are. And it seemed to me to be a whole lot better than sitting across the table from someone inside. I don't know if would that idea have occurred to me in 2019 before we all went through COVID and thought about mitigation tactics. Maybe it would have, but that's maybe one small benefit of coming through COVID is we can think about these things maybe more responsibly. And I would say, hey, you know, because I'm traveling and because I don't want to, you know, come down with something, how would you feel about, you know, going on a walk or just, you know, meeting at a park and, you know, sitting outside? It would just make me feel better. And hopefully the person that I'm trying to reconnect with would feel the same way.
I find it odd that we tend to underestimate our own contagion. When
yeah,
we're not
yeah.
feeling well and our, like our obligations to others yeah. to keep them safe. And we maybe overestimate the threat of others.
That's probably
being
true.
Sick. I'm not sure if we overestimate it or not. But it's still hard to bring it up socially sometimes. Like if somebody doesn't acknowledge that, well, I'm not sure if you want to sit down across the table from me or not. If somebody just assumes that this is going to be okay, it's still hard to bring it up and say, well, wait a minute, I'm not so sure I'm comfortable with that, especially I'm just starting out on this trip.
Yeah.
Right? So I just find that socially awkward
mm-hmm.
and not sure what to do about it sometimes. If I think your solution, if the weather is nice or if you're a place with a temperate climate, to suggest meeting outside for lunch somewhere,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't just lie to them and say, oh, we had to change in travel plans. And
I guess, I mean, it depends how well I know the person. But I can't say that I would probably do that. Unless I just like have reason to believe that this person is just sort of a non-compassionate person in every which way.
But you also just go to the restaurant and say, okay, I cross my fingers, hope I don't get
yeah.
sick, but then also like privately harbor this resentment towards the person
yeah.
for exposing
yeah,
you to a cold.
Yeah, I would just try to find a solution. Again, there's no perfect solution here, but like I think it is, you know, It can be kind of fun to, like, as an example, a couple years ago, I was in Des Moines. Travis and I were there for a long weekend, and I think I, like, posted something on social media, hey, I'm in Des Moines for the weekend, whatever. And a friend of mine, who we were, like, medium friends in high school, but, like, we weren't best friends by any means, but I knew over the years that he is a pilot, a commercial airline pilot for Southwest Airlines. And he messaged me and says, hey, you're in Des Moines. I have like a 36-hour layover in Des Moines. Want to get together? And like, that was fun. And I'd bring this up not because he was sick or I was sick. That didn't seem to be an issue. But I just bring that up that it is like those are things we should try to take advantage of. I mean, this was somebody I probably haven't seen in, I don't know, since we were both 17, 18, 19 years old. So it was like a fun thing. Yeah. So like, I don't think that we probably don't look for those situations enough, and we should look for those situations. So I guess,
by the way, it's one of the really good things about social media.
Yeah.
It allows us to reconnect with people that we normally would have lost complete contact with.
Yeah, like I knew this friend that lived in Des Moines, so it never even occurred to me that this person would. And actually, speaking of Des Moines, which I will tell you, for those who have not been, is an underrated Midwestern city. But another situation, actually, no. Two other situations of people who I had known, another high school friend of mine, actually, who her and her husband and child now live in Des Moines because of me sharing I was in their city. We got together, have now gotten together twice during visits to Des Moines, she and I have. And then another friend of mine who I knew when I lived in another part of Iowa, I knew he was in Des Moines, and we also kind of, so I mean, like, there are ways you can kind of stay in touch with people, and I just bring those instances up not to be the head of the Des Moines Chamber of Commerce, but to talk about, like, how it, I find it, and I think most people find it fun to, like, have these connections. And, like, my airline pilot friend, I would be happy to have lunch or dinner with him again sometime, but you know what? It's also possible I'll never see him again. And I mean, that's fine, I guess. But like, it was fun to do, and I would encourage anyone, assuming you're not battling a cold or some other communicable disease, to like go out of your way to try to make these and reconnect with people like that.
Yeah, and I also think it's important, like, if you are not feeling 100%, like, if you're feeling you might be coming down with something, or you have a lingering cold or some fever or something, not to put a burden on the other person.
Yeah, that's
to
true.
Say, like, yeah, no, or to take, like, to take precautions, but to just say politely, yeah, I'd love to get together with you. I'm not feeling the best, but, you know, I'm probably feeling good enough to have lunch. Is that okay with you?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And mm-hmm. But give them an easy way to say, yeah, no, maybe this isn't the best time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. I mentioned my friend, my airline pilot friend. I don't know if the dilemma you gave me was based on a real scenario, but you travel around the country a fair amount. Have you had a time where you're in a city where you show up thinking you don't know anyone and then make kind of a long ago connection like that?
I have in the past, but I haven't recently. I am looking forward this summer to going back to my hometown during the time of our annual big celebration.
Oh, don't tell me now. We've talked about this before. Oh, it's a great name, and I'm forgetting it. It is called?
Turkey Days.
Turkey Days in Frazee, Minnesota.
Turkey
but there's
Days.
A particular event there that we've talked about before, isn't there?
Maybe the demolition derby.
Maybe it was,
or it could be the water fights.
Okay.
It was like the Friday night water fights. So that's great because they bring out the fire hoses and they string up a cable between two semi trailers, like for probably 50 yards or so, and then you have two teams with the fire hose and there's a ball suspended from the cable.
Okay.
And you have to use the fire hoses to spray water on the ball to try to get it down to the opponent's end. So it's like a reverse tug of war.
Okay. And do you think activities such as that in your hometown of Frazee, Minnesota, make people think that their neighbors are morally good, even if the ball drops on the wrong side of the line?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because everybody's cheering, but nobody has a big investment in the outcomes. And everybody gets wet and feels miserable together. So the shared misery of all being wet, and like, it's actually usually a hot summer day, so it feels pretty good. So,
and you still have family in Frazee?
I don't have family there anymore.
But you still know people there?
But I haven't been back for Turkey Days for probably 20 years.
Okay.
And it's a time where a lot of people come back to the town.
And so, oftentimes, I know small communities, they'll often have like their high school reunions around that same time and other such activities.
I've only been to one high school reunion.
You've
I
been
feel
to
really
one
bad
more
about
than
that.
Me. Yeah. But I bet your graduation class size was how many students?
I think it was 120.
Oh, that's more than I would have guessed. Yeah, mine was like 475.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
I was from a larger school district, but all throughout my K-12 career, I guess that's what you call it, K-12 time, that our year was always like the one where they had an extra section. We just had a little bubble for whatever reason. Our year was a little bigger. But yeah, I've not done any high school reunions. And of course, with a class that size, I mean, there's like events and there's like someone who takes charge every 5 or 10 years. But I've never gone.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I will be. And when is that?
Last weekend in July.
And if anybody listening to the show right now wants to go to Frazee Turkey Days, you would recommend making reservations right now, because I'm sure hotels and restaurants book up very early.
It's almost impossible to get a room at the Hyatt Regency in downtown Frazee. So better book ahead. You just get whatever you can.
Because... Well, just so you know, Rick, I will be very flexible. If we ever need to record over Zoom, assuming Frazee has the internet, we can do that so you can live your dream of heading back and experiencing Turkey Days. Do you have a turkey call for that? You do?
No, we don't do turkey. You don't. Calls I'm sorry. Turkey
I,
days.
Sorry, I feel like but, I've. I feel like I don't mean to characterize your city.
But I am going to the Turkey Day parade. That's on Sunday afternoon. And
well,
that'll be a big thing. And then I think that's followed by the demolition derby. You know, it's been so long. I don't know if they do things in the same order as they used to.
But. You'll have to report back later this summer for all our listeners to see if they weren't able to make it to Turkey Days, what they missed. The Ethical Life Podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to check out Rick's column, which is often about ethics and maybe once in a great while about Turkey Days. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.